Good evening. I'm Kilo Echo Yankee is Mel. That's him. And I'm Kilo 2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. Mel and Dick try to organize this slightly crazy, enthusiastic crowd that gathers each Sunday evening to discuss their favorite subject, ham radio, wireless electronics in general. Then sometimes it branches off into other kinds of electronics and technical interest in space. And we're going to have some interesting things to tell you about space tonight. A person signs into the technical net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name. You have to give me your name again and again because I'm so darn forgetful. And the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. I'll be passing it over for you guys to sign in a minute. As you probably know, main purpose of the technical net is education. The wireless field contains some pretty complicated stuff. The schools and the books only do a partial job of introducing you to that particular material. And by way of the guys that gather, the gathering of the clan of ham radio operators in the tri-state area of New York City, in other words, northern New Jersey, southern New York State, and southwestern Connecticut, there's a lot of brain power in that area, and the guys will listen to the TechNet, hear a subject of their particular expertise, they'll chime in and give us the benefit of their past experience. The subjects that are discussed on the technical net are 90-some-odd percent of the time the subjects that you, the questioners, bring to the net. And they sometimes range from very simple to very complicated questions. Sometimes the questions are something that can't be answered in 10 minutes. Mel and I are now trying to assign 10 minutes for each question up until 9 o'clock when we go to the mailbag. And the mailbag usually, in other words, the email address, the people who give us an email question, let me drop.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
And there's something you have to do every minute and a half. You have to give a little drop to the reset the machine. But hey, we take a break at 9 o'clock for the younger people who are getting into ham radio, and some of them have sleeping deadlines, and so they can't stay up much beyond 9 o'clock. So we try to restrict our questions to about 10 minutes each up until 9 o'clock. We go to the email questions for 45 minutes or so, and then go back to the more deep questions. Last week, for instance, Dennis, W2IU, got bypassed, but it was very good that he did. His question is one that took us about 45 minutes to give him as much information as we think he needed to do a analysis or a diagnosis of his particular repeater, which is having a receiver sensitivity problems, and that's a very complicated problem. A single location repeater with marginal sensitivity. There's only about 10 things that can cause that. Alrighty, already signed in tonight, because I know we're going to get questions from John, KC2WGB, Wesley, N2XJN, and Joe, W2RYY. We know we're going to get questions from those. Those guys are already signed in. If there is anyone else that thinks they're going to have a question or a comment, give me your call letters and name right now. And that word, yes, K2RIW in the tech man.
Dick, before you start.
Yes. I think that was Rich N2EO. Somebody said before I start. Who was that?
KC2WGB. Dick, put me down after Mel's dissertation because I have a quick question, and this way we'll get on to him and let the other guys go first, please.
Okay. John's a very humble guy. Rich, that was you that also was signing an N2EO, if I heard you correctly?
Yes, it was, Dick, N2EO.
Okay, so we've got N2XJN, W2RYY, N2EO. Anyone else? Give me your call letters, name, and the word yes. Do so right now. K2RIW.
K2KF, John, yes. Again, the name is Dennis, and you already have that, because I heard the preamble, and yes.
Okay, K2KAF and Dennis, and W2IU. Well, listen, I'm anxious to hear what you've got to say, Dennis. Was it Kilo 2 Kilo Alpha Foxtrot? And if I've got the call letters correct, or correct me, and tell me your name, sir.
That's India Foxtrot, K2KIF. The name is John.
Okay, we got you, John. So, so far it is Wesley, Joe, Dennis, and John. Anyone else?
WA2, Victor, David, Henry, John.
Yes.
Okay, I heard WA2, Victor, David, Henry, John. And there was a double. Who was the other person?
Yeah, just to say good evening, Dick, with the group K2KEY.
I wonder who that masked man was. Okay, Mel. Alrighty, let's get rolling. What's the latest? Oh, by the way, you sent me an email to review, which was done by, can't think of the man's name right now. Dr. Gotta go back to my notes. Very interesting fellow. Transcendent M-E-Y-L, Mile. Scalar Wave Experiment. And he was at the Sheraton College Park Hotel in the United States taking his seeing equipment and demonstrating how he is transmitting energy, apparently losslessly or maybe even with some gain, across the table in the front of the room. It looks like he was transmitting energy about 10 feet by what he called forced resonance coupling over the earth, grounding the firmer the better and so on. Interesting material. So give us a little bit of interpretation of what you think is going on there, Wesley. N2XJN, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Well, the controversial scalar waves, and at first, because your English is much better, if you can just describe to the audience scalar waves theory or scalar waves principles. Back to you, Doug.
Yeah, he was showing what happens at roughly 7.2 megahertz, where he was getting, let's see now, something, he called that the scalar wave. And the 4.5 megacycles, at first he called it a hatch wave. Now, most of radio propagation, and I'm assuming that we're talking about something somewhat like radio propagation, normally is a scalar phenomenon, meaning that the signal that is transmitted through the medium, through the ether, through the ionosphere, through free space, normally it has a amplitude and a phase angle to it. In other words, as long as I don't move the transmitting antenna and the receiving antenna under an ordinary radio experiment, there is an exact phase relationship between what I transmit from the transmitting antenna and what I receive from the receiving antenna. The wave in space has polarization, depending on what polarization you decide to transmit. It's got a preferred E field, a preferred H field. It's got a certain phase angle. The frequency you receive is identical to the frequency you transmit as long as there's no Doppler shift happening because of motion. So most radio wave propagation is truly vector, is my understanding. A scalar phenomenon, like for instance the voltage coming out of a battery, we normally call that scalar. It has magnitude, but it doesn't have phase. Well, you could go one step further and I could look at the cross-sectional diagram of that battery. Let me drop. And I know where the positive terminal is. I know where the negative terminal is. I could say it has a kind of defined phase. I'm trying to think now of a good scalar phenomenon. The mass. Yes, I guess mass could probably be considered a scalar phenomenon. Although an object that you're measuring the mass of usually has a mass center. And it has different moments of inertia depending on which axis I rotate it around. So is a massive object fully scalar or is that fully polar? Here we go. Is it fully scalar or does it have some vector properties? If you dig deep enough, I suspect an awful lot of things that we think are scalar are really vector. It's got a direction, it's got a magnitude, and that's sort of what scalar means. A scalar vector network analyzer is a machine that applies a signal of known phase into something that you're measuring. It could be the standing wave ratio of your dummy load or your antenna. It could be the transmission characteristics of an amplifier. What comes out has a given amplitude. It might have gain or loss, and it has a certain phase angle. So it's a vector measurement that you use most of the time with a vector network analyzer. When he moved the signal generator, so to speak, from 7.2 megacycles down to 4.5 megacycles, it was a 4.6 megacycles, he said he went from a scalar wave to a hatcher wave. That was his word for it. Not quite sure what's happening there. I guess I could What I did was to click on your email address in order to get that particular Russian YouTube, is what I think it was. It was a YouTube presentation. I presume that is presented in the Russian language. All the wording around it was all Russian, to my knowledge. It looked like the Cyrillic alphabet, except that the
repeater, timeout, cancel.
The presenter was doing everything in the English language. He spoke English very well, and he was doing it at an American location. The Sheraton College Park Hotel is where he was doing the experiment. And for a while, he had trouble making electrical contact in the wall because he was using a European converter. His equipment was made for European voltages, which probably is 50 hertz at 220 volts, and he had a converter which was taking the 110 volts, 115 volts of American, 60 cycles, and doing the conversion to run the instrument. And occasionally he had some, at the end or near the end, he had some intermittent problems with that. An exciting-looking experiment. I guess you and I should be telling people the email address so that they could also visualize, so they could also see this video. It was rather well done. And the main thing that was taking place is that he had what looked like a Tesla coil-like thing, although it looked a little bit different. It was sort of a, I'm going to call it an 8-inch diameter spherical ball held on a tripod at the left-hand end of a conference table. The right-hand end of the conference table, about 10 feet away, was a similar object that was doing the receiving. And a pair of back-to-back light-emitting diodes was showing the energy that was being absorbed. I suppose, although he didn't make it clear, that there was a similar set of like back-to-back light-emitting diodes on the sending end. And on the assumption the diodes were identical, by the brilliance of the emitting diodes on the sending end and the brilliance of the emitting of the light-emitting diodes on the receiving end, and those brilliances being almost identical, you could see that the very high-efficiency energy was being transferred. He mentioned the fact that in some of the experiments he has done, he sometimes was getting 1,000% efficiency. That's what
repeater, timeout, cancel.
When he did the experiment in Berlin, he had 200% efficiency. When he did it in Munich, he had 300% efficiency. It's a little bit mysterious that the efficiency changes. He accounts for that by the ground conductivity, local ground conductivity, he believes was the major reason for that. He also talked about the fact that the majority of the coupling of these objects in space was a field capacitance, and that the Earth in between became the inductance. And that's a little bit mysterious to me also. Most people, when they talk about groundductivity, will talk about its primary component being resistance of the ground, resistivity. The quality of your grounding rods for lightning protection is a function of the resistance you can measure between them. Let me drop. So I've heard most people describe ground as a volumetric resistive material. This particular professor is calling it an inductive material. And the capacitance is the free space capacitance between these two spherical balls, I presume. And somehow with that combination, he's creating a kind of resonance. And so I haven't absorbed it all, as you can tell. I haven't quite figured out what all is going on. I wonder if the apparatus that you're constructing, Wesley, has some similarity to this particular demonstration. And do you think we should be telling other people what that email address is so that they could also view this? N2XJN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
N2XJN. Okay, Dick. Here is the situation. Yes, that is exactly what this professor... And this professor was a German university professor. I don't have it handy which university, but it wasn't Russian guy. The technology was invented by Russian scientists. So eventually came to Germany. Now, the scalar wave is a multi-dimensional saving wave. And when we're talking, I'm going to later on cover that the capacitive coupling is exactly what my free energy device that I'm doing. When we're talking about this professor claiming 1,000% of the efficiency, I stated, which actually was something that everybody could laugh at me, that I witnessed a 2.75 watts driving 150 watts for a period of 8 seconds, so they both actually died. So back to the theory. A scalar wave emanates out of fixed points. Let's say of the thumb. Tone-like vibration and scalar wave appear to move from one place to another, but in true, they are stationary points of light. They stay in one place. They are, how to this, strung together in sequences within the fabric of the cosmic motogenic field. Do I pronounce it properly? I don't know. But the appearance of the scalar wave movement is generated as a sequence of scalar wave points and are activated or lighted in synchronization one with the other. And the effect then confers the progressivity, flashing a series of bolts. Excuse my English. I'm trying the best that I can. So I would say, let me repeat myself. The effect can compare to the progressivity flashing a series of bulbs strung out in line. Off and on, off and on, off and on. One at a time, flashing the first bulb off and the second light, where it appears to the light has moved from one point into the another. So the scalar wave represents fixed point of perpetual fusion and fusion and emanate from the fabric of morphogenic fields. Now, if you help me out and explain to the audience what is the morphogenic field, because I'm already getting tired.
I'm not sure that I can explain that, and I'm looking now at the actual URL, I guess that's what it's called, in other words, the address you go to, and it's rutube.ru/tracks/1528568.html, and then a whole bunch of other symbols. It's unfortunately a very long email address. I presume there's probably a way if you just go to rutube.ru. I'd like to believe that maybe .com, I'm not sure. And maybe there's some keywords we can go to where it would automatically find it. To transmit all of this address is not easy. I am going to be asking Wesley how he found this particular one. It certainly is one of the better looking ones. The fact that it took place on a conference table in front of a large room full of people in an American hotel with a lot of witnesses strongly suggests that what was taking place most likely was not a hoax, if you know what I mean. There was a lot of witnesses, people helping him and so on. Although we didn't see under the table, I'd like to believe there's no mysterious wiring under the table. It was really wiring the transmitter and receiver that were about 10 feet apart. So therefore, I'd like to believe nothing. In fact, all the hardware was sitting on top of the tablecloth that was across the table. So unless he drilled holes for that tablecloth, so to speak, to put in the wiring, it looks like the transmitter and receiver system were thoroughly independent.
There was one point when he used his hands to cover the antenna of the receiver when he changed the frequency.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Yeah, that's another interesting part of it. when he was operating on, I believe it was the 4.6 megacycles, his hand would shield the wave. If he put his hand on the receiving device, he would change his resonance and it no longer would be picking up the signal. I'm not so sure, but when he was on 7.2 megacycles, and by the way, there was a frequency counter on the transmitter, so you could tell what frequency it was on. When he was on 7.2 megacycles, and he put his hand near the receiving device, I'm not sure that the light bulb got interrupted. I think he was saying that that was a different kind of a wave, that the hand didn't interrupt it. Did I misinterpret that one? Now, Wesley, go ahead.
I didn't hear the last few words. Can you repeat them?
Yes, when he was operating at 4.6 megacycles, and he put his hand on the receiving antenna, the light bulbs connected to the receiving antenna went out. So his hand was a shield or an interrupter or a detuner. But I think when he was operating in the beginning at 7.2 megacycles and he put his hand on the receiver, I'm not so sure the light went out. And I think that was one of his pieces of evidence that it was a different kind of wave when he changed the frequency. Over to you on that one, Wesley. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, you're right.
Who are you?
Yes, you're right. When he was using the frequency around 7 megahertz, there was, and he could use his hand to shield the antenna of the receiver, there was no change. But when he changed the frequency to the lower one, he used his hand and he proved that there is no light at the receiver bar. So, and he stated at that point that now he is using the ordinary radio waves. But do you think?
Dennis, did you say you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I just thought I'd remind you, while I'm no referee, you're going past your self-directed, self-imposed 10-minute limit on this question already.
Okay, it looks like we're going to have to come back to this one because it's not going to be an easy one to settle. And by the way, Don Good said last week, Dennis, that we didn't put you into a 10-minute limit because you needed a lot more information. Alrighty, I'm going to go on to the next person, and we're going to come back to this one, Wesley. This one's going to take a while. Joe was the next person who I officially signed in. Joe, what would you like to tell us or ask us tonight? W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick, W-A-2-R-Y, name is Joe. I'd like to ask you a theoretical question because I don't have exact information in front of me of measuring the difference in loss across a coax transmission line with doing a one-way, what's called a one-way insertion loss test, or actually measuring with power loss across the cable itself. Should there really be any difference in how that's done? One-way, obviously you put a way of measuring the power into the cable and then measuring the power out of the cable to track the difference at your loss. The second way is supposed to be using a precision short of the cable and sweeping the cable and looking at your high and low return loss reading, and then do the same thing with an open, looking at your high and lowest return loss readings on the instrument and taking the average of those readings. It's supposed to give you the theoretical, divided by, it's supposed to give you the theoretical one-way insertion loss of the cable. Do you agree with this?
There's sort of a yes and a no to that one, Joe. If I really want to know the insertion loss of a transmission line, I apply a signal at one end, properly terminate the other end, and find out how much signal comes out the other end by way of a Bird watt meter or a power indicating dummy load and so on. That's the ideal way. If that piece of transmission line is going up 300 feet of tower, for instance, it may be very inconvenient to put a power sensing device at the top of the tower. If you've got a relay or some other technique up there by which you can create what you believe to be an ideal short circuit or an ideal open circuit, in theory what happens is the signal that you put into the cable goes up the cable, experiences the insertion loss on the way up, hits the pure open circuit or short circuit, or if you like, even a pure reactor, but it hits some kind of a non-absorptive device at the end of the cable. A short circuit or an open circuit at the end of a cable at most reasonable frequencies will absorb no power, will radiate no power, And the reason I said that reasonable frequencies, let me drop. If I was doing the experiment at 10 gigahertz, the center conductor coming out of a type N connector is a kind of very short antenna at 10 gigahertz, and it will do some radiating, but at reasonable frequencies, below 1,000 megs. The open circuited type N connector absorbs no power. Every bit of the power that gets there reflects off the open circuit. That's the magic of a transmission line. Any energy that doesn't get absorbed at the far end by your antenna or your load gets reflected back. That reflected energy, which is essentially equal to the energy that hit that open circuit connector, goes flowing back down, goes through the insertion loss the second time, and therefore, if you can measure the forward power you've put into the cable in the shack, and if you can measure the reverse power coming back out of the cable in the shack, that insertion loss, you know, has been through the cable twice. You divide that loss in two, and you know the loss of the cable in one direction. That's the ideal world. Now let's get into the things that can go wrong. As I said before, the ideal way is to really measure what power flows through the cable. That's the gold standard. But because of inconvenience, if you want a good approximation, you do this Vizwar test. And by that I mean, by measuring the amount of forward power and reverse power with a well-calibrated Bird wattmeter in the shack, that's one way. Connecting it to a good vector network analyzer will also show you what is the S11, which is called voltage reflection coefficient. And you go through a very simple formula of squaring that number, and you know the ratio of the power that came back versus the ratio of the power that went forward. The reason you square that number is it's a voltage number, and power is a function of voltage squared. And the network analyzer is giving you a normalized number. In other words, if it tells you that the S11 is 0.5, and
repeater, timeout, cancel.
Because a vector network analyzer always normalizes everything to 1, you assume the magnitude of what it transmitted into the cable was 1. What you got back is 0.5 in my example. Half the voltage returned, double the 0.5, and you get 0.25. In other words, a quarter of the power came back that went out. In that particular example, you could say the return loss out and back, going through the cable twice, is a 4-to-1 power ratio. That's what 0.5 squared is. 0.25 over 1 is a 4-to-1. You could call that 6 dB if you like, and therefore you would assume the cable had 3 dB of loss. If the cable was really flat, in other words, properly installed connectors, no bumps in the cable, and properly installed connectors on both ends, then measuring the insertion loss in that manner will give you a very accurate answer, maybe 95% accurate or so. The problem is that when the cable really has bumps in the cable, improperly installed connectors, and so on, now you're not getting the major reflection you're getting is from the open circuit at the far end. That's the good news. But all other bumps, any other disturbance of the impedance along the length of the cable will give you a reflection. So it's a little bit like looking through triple thermal pane glass, if you know what I mean. You're getting a reflection from each surface of the glass. Well, the radio signal going down that imperfect cable, let me drop, is also getting a reflection from each individual perturbation, each bump in the cable, each improperly installed connector, each place where you turn the cable around the corner too sharply, and so on. So now all of those individual reflections, as you sweep in frequency, some of them come back down toward the shack, so to speak, all in phase, sometimes all out of phase, and you get a kind of a ripple characteristic. You could, if you want to, do some kind of a averaging. And should you do the averaging in voltage or in power, I'm not sure. And you could come up with an approximation. All that peaks and valleys are going to tell you is what's the worst case and the best case. It doesn't necessarily tie down your particular case, because when the signal is going through your mysterious piece of cable the first time, and some of those reflections are occurring, What arrives at the top of the cable, which is what you really care about at the top of the tower, is a certain phase relationship between all of those bumps and the primary signal. What comes back down to the shack has different lengths because of the round trip to each one of those perturbations. So the peaks and valleys you see in the shack will not, in general, correspond to the peaks and valleys at the top of the tower. Unless you do a much more elaborate test, let me drop. If you had to absolutely positively get the best possible answer from the shack, because it would be much too expensive to hire a rigger to climb the tower, you could, with the proper piece of software on a vector network analyzer, do what's called the Steinhelfer technique. Steinhelfer technique sweeps something like 1,024 individual frequencies, measures the amplitude and the phase of the reflected signal in the shack at each one of those frequencies, puts that all into a great big data matrix, applies it to a very fancy program called the Steinhelfer technique, and it derives very high resolution time domain reflectometry. It'll therefore give you a XY picture where the X-axis is length along the cable, 0 to 300 feet in my example. The Y-axis, the vertical axis, will tell you how big is the bump at each one of those locations. You look at all those individual spikes, and you apply the right mathematics. Now you know everything that's going on. Well, very few of us own a really good time-domain reflectometer, a direct time-domain reflectometer made by either Tektronix or Hewlett-Packard, are the two major brands in the United States. I'm guessing that also Rohde & Schwarz probably makes one, as well as a number of other companies. Or if you've got a real good vector network analyzer, and you bought the auxiliary piece of software called the Steinhelfer technique, which will cost you quite a few bucks, then you get the whole answer. So the technique of sweeping and measuring the peaks and valleys and doing an average, that's not a bad approximation, but it's not going to be perfect. Very few things are. Now that you know a little bit more of the details, you can sort of see what you're up against there, Joe. I wonder if any of that helps. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
K-2-K-E-Y, comment.
Bell recognized, but Joe first. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, the reason I ask is because I've seen in the wireless industry, typically this is what's done with an antenna rigger. The antenna rigger will initially test the cable, and he'll put a calibrated short and a calibrated open on the cable, and he'll do exactly what you said. I'm not sure what frequency span, I guess they pretty much go across the frequency span of the operating system. If in the case of PCS, they might sweep from typically 1850 to 1990 using something like a SiteMaster made by Anritsu, something along those lines, because it's small and portable. And he will take a reading and look at the peak. The highest peak coming back and the lowest peak coming back, store that, and then do the same thing with a short, and it'll take the average reading of those divided by half. That's supposed to be your theoretical one-way insertion loss. And I've made measurements on a cable and come up with slightly different readings than that, in-house piece of cable. That's why I asked this particular question. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, it is a toughie. When you're using a vector network analyzer in the calibrate mode, and you put on a short, open, and perfect dummy load at the far end of your piece of test cable, because all of it's in your laboratory, the so-called 12-point correction procedure takes about 1,024 readings in frequency and phase of the S11, the voltage reflection coefficient, of your cable under those three conditions, applies all of that great big data set to a 12-point correction program, which thoroughly takes out all of the idiosyncrasies of your cable. You then hang your device under test, your unknown, at the far end of that cable, and the vector network analyzer rather accurately tells you exactly what your device is, as if the end of the cable just happened to be right at the front panel, so to speak. It takes out all the idiosyncrasies of the cable. So therefore, that calibration procedure, by what it did, knows everything about your cable. Therefore, I think there is probably a way that you can dig into that data set of that calibration procedure and therefore know exactly what the cable is going to do in one-way insertion loss at every one of those frequencies. The raw data is there. And whether or not the manufacturer has given you the pull-down or the subroutine, so to speak, that gives you that data is an interesting question. But know that the data is there, and now that we know the data is there, and we can start asking the questions more effectively, more intelligently, of the people who manufacture or demonstrate to us a vector network analyzer, let me drop for a second, whether the piece of test cable is the 3-foot-long thing that you use in the laboratory, or the 300-foot thing you use outside the outside in the real world, the network analyzer doesn't really give a darn. It does all of that calibration anyhow. So I see a beautiful application technique here that we haven't known to ask for. We didn't know that we needed this until you brought it to our attention, Joe. Now, when Mel does these things, I'll bet you he did it with a real time domain reflectometer. I'll bet you found one of those at a flea market, and you're one of the very few hams who owns one of those. Therefore, you can really characterize your transmission lines. A little bit of a guess on my part here, Mel. K2KEY, how would you dial this one? K2RIW in the tech net.
Yes, this is K2KEY. Well, I'd make two suggestions. Yes, I have a fairly nice TDR, and it's a graphic display, as I explained last week. We were talking about that TDR. And the use of the TDR, if you take, for instance, they give you in the menu, the program menu there, many different cables, dozens and dozens of cables and their numbers, so that the piece of equipment, once you punch in that information, pre-programs the TDR to make accurate measurements of that cable that's in the list. However, there's another way to do it. Now, if you're interested, let me let it drop. You're interested basically in this piece of cable that's, like you say, going up the tower, how it's going to behave on the frequency that you're basically installing it on the antenna to be used. So, another way of doing it, and I really want to know what is my loss is going to be in dB, basically. I'd like to work strictly in dB. As you and I talk about at midnight last week, is the return loss bridge. And this is a much cheaper, or I should say a simpler device to obtain. And the proper use of an RL bridge with the number of formulas that are involved in RL, you can easily determine cable loss, Dick. Over.
I think there's a little bit of a yes or a no. I'm going to agree 90% with what you said, Mel, but I'm going to show you a little bit of an error. A return loss bridge is a lumped circuit equivalent for HF frequencies, usually, of an ideal directional coupler. At microwave frequencies, the guys use a real directional coupler. When you take it apart, it's got a straight-through line, it's got a quarter wavelength long coupled line that lies parallel to the straight-through line, and they have numbers like 10 dB of coupling coefficient or 20 dB, and a well-made one has got 15 or 20 dB of directivity, and an instrumentation grade one can have 50 dB of directivity. So a real microwave directional coupler allows you to figure out forward versus reverse power quite accurately. A return loss bridge is the lump circuit equivalent of one. And by the way, there's a beautiful one in the ARL antenna book. Unfortunately, it's on that directional watt meter, which is on the instrumentation pages, about two-thirds of the way through the book. There's a beautiful lump circuit directional coupler in there. You could call it a return loss bridge, which again tells you what is the ratio of forward power to reverse power. And that tells you 90% of what you want to know about your cable. And if your cable is a reasonable cable, good connectors, not too many bumps, by measuring the return loss in decibels and dividing by two, because the signal has been through the cable round trip two ways, it'll give you a rather good answer. But in the worst case situation where there are real multiple bumps, the reverse power you get back into the shack, whether you measure it with a return loss bridge or with an ideal directional coupler, is the result of not only the pure short or open circuit you put at the far end of the cable, but it's also due to the partial reflections of the other bumps you've got in the cable that are all making their own individual reflections from different ranges downrange on the cable.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Therefore, as you sweep in frequency, all of those individual bumps at different ranges down the cable, different number of wavelengths, will come together as a reflected combination of signals in the shack, which are sometimes co-phase, sometimes antiphase, and as you sweep in frequency, if the cable is not perfect, you'll get a ripple to it. And then do you look at the positive peak, the negative peak, or something in between? There's various kinds of mathematics. So it's an extremely good answer. It's not a perfect answer. But my understanding, Mel, and maybe you and I have got a slight disagreement and a philosophy on this one, a properly calibrated return loss bridge, to me, is a low-frequency, nearly ideal directional coupler. It does separate the forward-going signal versus the reverse-going signal. I wonder what you think of that philosophy, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, most definitely. Why I was referring to a return loss bridge, it's a simple device that gets you very accurately into the ballpark. Yes, you're right. There could be a lot of bumps on the cable, and that's what my TDR will, AEA TDR will show, because it's a graphic display, and you can see the bumps in the cable. You can actually even tell on that, it'll tell you at the far end, are you shorted or are you open? And how far away is it? Or is there a short or an open or a damage to the shield or whatever? And it shows you graphically, and with the calibration readout on it, it'll tell you exactly how many feet down line from the connector this is taking place. However, a good go, no go, would I, why I mentioned, let me let it drop an RL bridge, I'll explain. Okay, if we took an RL bridge, and we know that the return loss measurement at the antenna, let's say we make an antenna measurement, and we know the return loss measured at the transmitter, then applying the formula, like you say, dividing by 2, or 2 times, or minus 2 times the loss in a coax, will give us in dB, actually, what, because like you say, it's going up the cable and coming back down. So if you want to know what the total is, you get the total. If you want to know what it is just going one way, of course, you can divide by 2. But by applying that RL at the antenna equals RL to transmitter minus 2 times L at the coax will give you a ballpark idea of what's happening. By knowing any of those two gives you the third constant, Dick, over.
Yeah, the nice thing about the return loss bridge is that it, at least one kind of embodiment is it basically is a Wheatstone bridge. With good careful layout, I think it's an assemblage of 4 resistors, or one of them is the unknown. And then you put the power across the opposite ends of the diamond, and at right angles you put the power sensing device, rectifier into a meter, or the pickup to your oscilloscope, or network analyzer, spectrum analyzer, and so on. So the nice thing about a return loss bridge is that one way of building it is quite simple schematic-wise. And so you get an awful lot out of that for very little. The return loss bridge that you're using, Mel, is it commercially made or did you homebrew it? Over to you, Mel.
This is K2KEY again. Mine is a commercial unit. It's funny. You know, you talk about an instrument, and a lot of people will walk by it and say, I don't know, what the heck do you do with that thing? It looks like it has 3 quarts on it or whatever. I walked by a place and I saw this. It's called the ANZAC, A-N-Z-A-C. ANZAC makes return loss bridges, and they run anywhere. This one runs somewhere around, I don't know, $700 to $1,000. I saw it at a hamvention, and I said to the guy, how much you want for it? He said, well, I don't know, make me an offer. I said, I got a $5 bill in my hand. He said, grab the $5 bill, and I walked away with it, Dick.
Fantastic. When these guys don't know what they're selling, and by the same token, I bought this instrumentation grade waveguide 8 to 12 gigahertz 20 dB directional coupler with 50 decibels of directivity. I'll bet you when Alfred Singer made that thing back in the 60s, I'll bet you they sold it for a few $1,000s and I bought it for $2. So, and thank goodness I bought 2 of them. Unfortunately, one of them was broken inside and I've been trying to fix it. So, there are times when at a flea market, if you know what you're looking at, you can get a real bargain. Alrighty, let me go over to Dennis next. Dennis, I know it's kind of soon. Hopefully you guys had a chance to make a few of those measurements. Hopefully by Tuesday or Wednesday, as I remember checking, the TechNet was recorded on amateurradio.tangovictor, and you could play it all back. I went and listened to that, I guess it was Thursday or so. I listened to all of that discussion we had with you at around 11 o'clock. I think it was on the third reel, if you know what I mean. And so if you took notes from that and presented it to your crowd, you know a little bit more about what they're up against. I wonder if you had a chance to make any of those measurements. I wonder how it's going with your particular height, your particular 5G high technology repeater in New Jersey. W2, India Uniform, K2RIW in the TechNet. Go ahead, Dennis.
Okay, this is W2IU, and, I think we've got a handful of disappointments as to did they do any of the measurements. I don't think anybody that I told about it listened until Thursday, and even Thursday I myself still hadn't gotten to it, so I hope those programs, those transcriptions are still available in one way, shape, or form, because I had gone into amateurradio.tv, I guess it was on Sunday night, to see if the previous week's recording was still there, and it wasn't, or at least I could not get anything out of that website, so I presume the server was down or whatever he'd use it over there, but as it is, there was nothing on Sunday night, and then I did some quick emails out to let people know that our stuff is up there, and it should be available for us to listen to, so you might let us know whether that is still there. As far as them doing any measurements, funny thing happened to us on the way to the TechNet tonight. First of all, somebody started checking cables and how things were connected, and we found out that, oh, this is on the wrong connector. We apparently had a line going to our 2-meter antenna for the 440 repeater. So when they got that straightened out and put the right line onto the right terminal, a lot of the descents went away. Second of all, it rained rather profusely last week, which also cut down on a lot of the descents. So there may be some sort of a reaction that was beginning to build up and take place over the summer because it was so dry, and now that it's got moisture back into the system, a lot of the problems seem to have gone away besides changing the cables. So how soon they get to making these measurements, and I do know that Eric is doing a lot of his own research work and probably did listen to that later than we thought, but nevertheless, the notes and the material are there to do it at some point in time, but I don't think it happened within the last week. New question for you, very simply, and I know you're going to comment. You know a lot of these dipole antenna diagrams suggest using a one-to-one balun inside as the center insulator. In any event, obviously people take down dipoles, and they salvage the balun. That was put in and possibly worked well for any number of years. Now those used balluns are turning up at the flea markets, at the ham fest. Is there any way to test the darn thing to find out if it's good or whether it's there at the flea market at the ham fest for a reason?
And that's a good question. First of all, the material that goes on to the amateurradio.tangovictor website under ARRL TechNet or Limark TechNet, those recordings will be there for years. You go there right now and the last 4 or 5 years worth of recordings are there. What happened this particular week is either last Sunday's material got onto that website approximately Wednesday or Thursday, I'm not sure which day it was. And at first the material is just put there as pure one-hour reels off all 4 or 5 of them. Later on, Mike Perry, KC2NJI, who runs that website for us, for everybody, he actually listens to them and documents them, so therefore he writes down every 10 minutes or so what was the subject being discussed. But at first, they're there without documentation. And once they're put up there, they're there for years on end. So don't worry about that. They're not going to disappear on you. The data is almost a permanent recording. That's the good news. Let me drop. Also, one of the things that happens is some kind of an error in the machine that does all the recording and storage of the material. Sometimes during the first week, when you download material, it doesn't play back. There's some kind of an error in the machine. Mike eventually discovers the error and corrects it. When I listened on, I think it was Thursday, there was no problem. The audio sounded good. Occasionally, depending on whether a person is using a Linux machine or a DOS machine or whatever, depending on the particular computer they got, it's a little bit more difficult to set things up properly to hear the audio with good fidelity. But you'll eventually iron out those problems. You don't have to worry about the recordings go away, and eventually the recordings will get better. A couple of weeks downrange, you'll eventually have it documented as to you'll be able to go directly to the right minute of the right hour to start hearing your particular material. So that part's going to go away. When it comes to connecting the wrong antenna, let me drop. If you connect a 2-meter repeater to a 450 antenna, you're going to get rather poor sensitivity on receive, and that's not so great on transmit. If you connected a 450 repeater to a 2-meter antenna, that will work a little bit better, but still it's not going to work well. And in order to really get maximum isolation out of the duplexing filter, it really wants to see the exact same load that it's going to see in the real world. The wrong antenna connected to the duplexer is going to present the wrong load, and therefore, quite possibly, the isolation that you carefully tuned in the duplexer will be degraded somewhat. And the quickest way to get electronic desensitization is for the isolation between transmitter and the receiver, 600 kc away, not being more than 120 dB. That'll overload the receiver front end, and it creates a kind of desens that's reasonably easy to detect by way of the 50-ohm dummy load test, where you make a measurement of sensitivity with the transmitter turned on and with the transmitter not turned on. An ideal system will have identical sensitivity with or without the transmitter turned on. Any change in that sensitivity, if it changed by 3 dB, you've got 3 dB of desensitization, so to speak. Now, when it comes to the balun on a half-wave dipole, let me drop. If you actually took one of those apart, Dennis, you'll find out that the piece of coaxial cable going down that long white tube, there's a SO239 connector at the bottom, and you got two screw eyes or whatever at the top. There's just a simple piece of coax cable going that down the tubing. The center conductor goes to one of the screw eyes. The shield goes to the other screw eye. But along the length, there's a stacking of toroids on the outside of the coax. Those toroids drastically increase the apparent inductance of the outside. In other words, when current flows down a wire, or when current flows down the shield of your coaxial cable, the current, by definition, creates a magnetic field that wraps around the cable. If you point your thumb in the direction of the current flow, your fingers wrapping around the cable show you where the magnetic field goes as circles around the cable, around the wire, around the cable, doesn't matter. You put toroids in that location, the magnetic field wrapping around the cable now does it 50 times better if you're using material with a mu of 50 at that frequency. Because the magnetic field flows through the toroids around the cable 50 times better than air, that means the apparent inductance of that piece of cable is 50 times higher. Rough number. So you can even make yourself a poor man's balun by taking quite a few feet of cable and wrapping it into a tight set of circles and taping it all together. That's one way of making a balun. You're really creating an RF choke so that the current that wants to flow down the outside of the cable can't do it. But these balun structures are so nice and compact with the toroids inside, they do the job very, very well. You're about to ask, can they fail? Let me drop. And the answer is no. I mean, there's very little you can do to damage those toroids that are wrapped around the outside of the cable inside of that balun structure. Yes, if the guy threw it down a metal set of stairs and it bounced real bad and you cracked some of those toroids, I guess it's possible. Testing it would be kind of tough. I can think of a couple of tests, but it's rather difficult, and interpreting the results would be difficult. So the quickest way to find out is it good would be to do an X-ray of it. You don't want to take it apart because you'll damage the weatherproofing. But because the device is so darn simple, it's nothing but a bunch of toroids stacked along the outside of the coax cable inside of that white piece of tubing. I think unless you pay an awful lot of dollars for them, you can't go wrong buying used toroids. There's very little you can do to use them up, if you know what I mean, Dennis. Whiskey 2, India Uniform, K2RIW on the deck net.
Hey, I want to comment.
Go ahead, Mel.
Yeah, a number of those current balloons have actually a toroid with a type of winding on a trifile, a winding on them, because they're converting. In many cases, you'll see they're a 2-to-1 or a 4-to-1 balance, whatever. So they're not simple. The one like you say, the using just the toroids around the stacked toroid. They call that one the stacked toroid type of, and it's basically a straightforward, straight step that acts like a transformer in there. But a pure, you know, the pure ones that they're selling supposedly for a dipole claim that the a dipole being supposedly around 70 some odd ohms in space will require a 1.5-to-1 balance. So they use actually got a toroid in there with a winding over.
Yeah, the version with a winding that does an impedance transformation, I think is the more rare one, Mel. I think that 95% of the ones you're likely to buy at a flea market are 1-to-1. And almost all of the 1-to-1s are the simple toroid type. So, depending on how it's marked, I think you know pretty much what you're getting, even if it's the kind with a more complicated winding inside. Again, about the only way you could damage one of those would be to really throw it down a very tall staircase, so to speak, and bounce it on the concrete and crack the toroid. Very few of them could be damaged with high power. Yes, in theory, a guy could put 5 kilowatts to one and burn up something inside, but most likely you would see some kind of charring on the outside of the package. I think there's not very much risk in buying a used one of those toroids as I see it, Dennis. Whiskey 2, India Uniform, K2RIW at the TechNet.
Okay, I appreciate that. That's a good guideline to look at. You know, next time I'm at the flea market, and I guess probably the next one I'm going to get to is going to be maybe even pack rats down there in Pennsylvania. I think that's October the 3rd. But in any event, at least I'll know what I'm looking at, and I'll feel secure if I don't see any cracks in the plastic, meaning that the water and the moisture got into it, then I guess the unit is good and usable at that point. And maybe even that happens. You might comment on that as to whether you got cracked plastic and whether moisture is going to ruin anything, which, considering there's a piece of coax inside there, we're all conditioned to realize that moisture getting into coax is not a good thing, and the next thing you know, you try to replace it and stuff like that. The final comment on the tower descents and all that sort of stuff is that they did talk to the Rowan engineers, and 45G apparently has about a useful life of about 10 to 11, maybe 12 years tops, of which this stuff is, and of which this tower has already been in place that amount of time. And Rowan is now installing, even in backyards, the Rowan 55, which is, I think, one of the kind that you had mentioned that you have. So as a guideline right there, people are now talking in terms of replacing our tower, which I guess the next question is going to come, and we'll save this for next week because I do have to get out of here, is going to be, is there some way to bypass the tower, in other words, run grounding down through it on the inside and just use the tower for strictly support, isolate the antennas away from it with some, I guess, plastic or whatever kind of, you know, wrapping we could make, not insulating to wrap it. And we'll keep that for next week, too, because I can't really say tonight anymore. But
repeater, time out.
Okay. You timed out the machine 30 seconds ago, but I heard everything on the input, Dennis, so not to worry. That so-called Rhone engineer or Rhone salesman you talked to that told you the tower is good for 10 or 11 years, that is extremely severe pronouncement. The Rhone catalog for rural installation of their Rhone 25 catalog a few years ago, maybe 10, 15 years ago, used to claim 20 to 25 years of service life. In an industrial environment where there's heavy acid rain or whatever, I think they knock those numbers down to something like 15 years. But you've got good galvanizing for 20 to 25 years if it's not a heavy industrial environment. The tower you're listening to me on right now is a Rhone number 6 tower installed in 1969. That makes it, what, 41 years ago? Yeah, 41 years ago is the Rhone number 6 tower. You're listening to this particular antenna. My other tower is a Rhone 55 that was installed in 1989.